sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Oil and markets decouple this week. Wrong way for stocks, unfortunately. Materials drops and Crocs pops. Retailers get hammered after earnings disappoint. And we'll discuss the anatomy of a bounce. All this and much more on episode number 463 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And how are you? Andrew Horowitz here. It is the Disciplined Investor Podcast, where we come together and meet every week to talk about, well, the markets, what's going on in the economies of the world, the news, maybe a little education, maybe a little bit of ideas, maybe some things that can help you along in your investing process, your financial planning. And by the way, thanks for all your great emails last week. We had, if you didn't listen last week, we spent some time talking about asset allocation, more of a traditional style of investing. We went over things like efficient markets and mean reversion trades. We talked about how to choose a mutual fund, ETFs, the differentials, what to look for, what to find. Kevin Hoffman was my guest. He actually works here, and he does a lot of the work in the area of the research, the looking beneath the surface at what's going on with the economies, with things like our investment choices in terms of the global allocation portfolios, where it's comprised of a lot of mutual funds and diversified investment strategies. One of the things that I got a few different questions that were really interesting on the whole idea of expense ratios and looking at the cost factors. And again, listen to that episode last week where we talked about some of this. But basically, yeah, it makes a lot of difference in terms of choosing, let's say, mutual fund A, mutual fund B, mutual fund C, and looking at what managers charge, where the risk-adjusted returns are, Sharpe ratios, things like that, alpha, and understanding on really what is in the portfolio and how they construct it. But more importantly, the returns that are provided by these, you know, what is it compared to risk? I mean, how much risk do they take to get to that particular return? I always talk about, you take two investments and you look at them and they both perform the same, but one had much more volatility during, let's say, a 10-year period, much more volatility. I mean, like all over the place. But in the end, they got to the same place. The problem is, well, when looking at it in hindsight, it's very easy. Well, who cares, right? They got to the same place. What's the difference? But the fact is that that's not how we invest. That's not how you invest, right? What happens is that you see things maybe on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. You review it, you analyze it. And what ends up happening is that you actually will choose to possibly do away with an investment that's not performing during a certain time period, during a cycle. And what happens is that you don't stick with it. And therefore, you maybe didn't get the full potential of the return that you were looking for with that investment during a certain cycle. And that pertains to this mutual fund I'm talking about, that maybe you sold it out too early and you decided to go somewhere else and maybe you picked the wrong one. So we have to be very careful in terms of the interim volatility of investment that matches the actual risk factors for our own risk tolerance to make sure that we can have that stick-to-itness of the investment over the long term. Because otherwise, what's going to happen is that you're going to end up selling things maybe much too early. Well, this weekend I went over and to the movie theater and I had some very salty popcorn, by the way. I've decided I'm done with popcorn. It's just, it always makes me feel lousy the next day in terms of just retaining water and ugh. Anyway, saw Money Monster. I thought it was kind of interesting. This is a movie with I'll get in that in a second. George Clooney. Not Jim Cramer. George Clooney. And it was interesting. It was modeled around a very flamboyant and a very outspoken and cocky a host that was talking about money and making some kind of guarantees in a way, and really, you know, all this was going on. And it was way too much similarity to the Mad Money Show with Jim Cramer. Now, I looked up and I wanted to see, well, was there a lot of thought that this was a mirror image? Was it a commentary on that show? I mean, what's going on with Jodie Foster, who was the producer of this, and George Clooney, which George Clooney, don't forget, a lot of times makes social statements. So I was thinking maybe there's some correlation or maybe some kind of link in there. There was a lot of news out that, yes, there was some genesis of the idea of this movie that was based on some of the time on Mad Money when Jim Cramer was talking about Bear Stearns. Remember back in the day when all the banks were collapsing, or at least looking like they were going to collapse. And Jim Cramer came out and said, do not sell your Bear Stearns. It's a great company. Nothing's going to happen. It's not in trouble. And within days, the company collapsed, went out of business. That was clearly not a good time for Mad Money, CNBC, and Jim Cramer. And this movie had a lot of things that were, I would say, similar to that kind of situation. Not exactly. There was some differences. I recommend you see. It was kind of, well, it wasn't great. It was an okay movie. It was entertaining for an evening. But I thought it was interesting how there's going to be something out on this. You'll see somebody's going to, I think Jim Cramer is going to probably come out and talk about this, probably try to defend himself. There's going to be some other shows that will bring up. Too bad Jon Stewart's not around anymore. But there'll be some other shows that will bring up the correlation between the news media, the type of hype, the investment programs, the business news stations that are out there that are trying to make it more of an entertainment process rather than news and information research. And the question of vetting of guests and the vetting of companies that come on and allowing what to say. So, but anyway, just a little anecdote on market-related entertainment that I thought was kind of interesting. Let's take a look at what is going on and what has gone on last week in terms of markets, because it was a down week for markets last week. By the end of the week, by the way, the S&P 500 is barely at the zero point again for the year to date. NASDAQ is down about 5.7, and Dow Jones is up about 0.5% for the year. But some of the news really was pushed out. If you remember last week and the week before, I've been talking about my concern about retail sales. And particularly, I've been really, really talking about the big box retailers. If you remember some time ago, I had this rant that went off the rails on my experience that I had, actually two different experiences at Macy's. I went to Macy's to buy a kind of a fun shirt for Saturday evening, you know, not a dress shirt per se, but something that I can get maybe that would be some colorful, you know, nice looking shirt, casual cocktail attire, you know, a fun night out. And I went to Macy's and I was just overwhelmed and I got so aggravated because the way they set the store up was just absolutely unfriendly for shopping, to say the least. So I went and I just couldn't buy anything. And I was just so frustrated that they would do such a thing. And I realized that this was more than just a simple change of overall consumerism in terms of how people were buying their clothing. It was not just simply the idea that millennials are no longer buying 17 shirts and 22 pairs of jeans and from these big box retailers, that maybe they're doing a lot more online and maybe this is what's happening with other people. No, it was much more than that. It was much more of the idea of how these department stores are marketing and what they are doing incredibly wrong and making it very difficult for the average consumer to go buy something. Well, two things happened over the week. I'll start with the last, which was kind of interesting. And again, it may not be related, but the first thing that happened was at the end of the week, the Commerce Department reported a big jump in retail sales, about 1.3%. It's not a big jump. It's a big jump because we've had such lousy numbers for such a long period of time. So the 1.3% increase is really good when you compare it to the other numbers that we've seen before. But a 1.3% gain in April in U.S. retail purchases, the core retail sales, which was impressive at 0.9%. Now, if you take out cars and trucks, retail sales were still up 0.8%. So therefore, that's pretty good. consumers got back into the fray and started to actually spend again after a number of months that they were just simply sitting on the sidelines. Now, one of the things that we did see was, for example, Macy's came out with their earnings, and that not only were their earnings absolutely awful, but their outlook was just as terrible. Stock was down 15% on the print. We saw some other companies like Dillard's and Kohl's and a few of the other big box retailers follow suit with their pretty negative numbers. The guidance was awful. Stocks got just obliterated. And that was something that we had been looking to see if that was going to be a follow through from the last several quarters where they've been seeing a substantial and significant and also consistent amount of slowdown in their overall sales. So let's just put this in the box of big box retailers, no change. Something is really wrong there, and they need to make a significant amount of progress in their marketing and who they're marketing to, understanding their audience, as well as maybe some further store closures, as well as maybe an inventory cull. Kind of go through the store and look at what is selling, what isn't. Just really an entire shift. And I would actually, frankly, say that while some of the management's very good, maybe there needs to be consideration for some of the sales and marketing side of things and the buyers to be replaced and shifted around because they're not keeping pace with what the consumer wants these days. And consumers, by the way, there was a major improvement in sentiment overall last month. The University of Michigan came out last week, and we saw a big bounce. We saw about a seven point move to the upside to about almost 96 in May. That's pretty good. I mean, we're talking about sub 90 prior to that. Now, we saw that this was good because it aligned with some of the initial claims that have been really good in terms of jobs, wage growth that has been better. Yes, we saw that jobs number that was definitely lukewarm at best, 160,000 print on the jobs numbers last Friday or a week ago Friday. But still, we're seeing that jobs are being added. That's good for an economy. We're seeing that consumer sentiment is up. That's generally good for an economy. We're seeing the follow through with retail sales. That's good for the economy. Obviously, there's a major a dislocation at best when it comes to many of the retail stores out there. And many of them we're seeing that the old lines like the Gap, and we see Aeropostale going bankrupt, a variety of other ones that just cannot understand the current state of the consumer and get into their wants and desires to buy their products. Very similar to what we've seen historically with companies that just can't see a shift in either demographics or buying trends. So there was definitely some positive numbers overall on the economic front here in the U.S. Now, over in China, we did see that there was a very mixed bag. Over the weekend, last weekend, there was some mixed numbers, and markets really didn't play well with that. And there was a continuation of the slowdown that we're seeing. And then on Tuesday, actually over the night, Monday, there was a CPI print over in, the inflation print over in China, and it stabilized. Markets were just like, yeah, man, this is awesome. You know, we see that there's all these definitely negative numbers that are being coming out of China. And now we're seeing, one number, one economic print. That's good. Well, let's rally the markets. Let's just buy in because all things are better now because this one number, this inflation number is much better than we expected. Turn of the corner. That's how quickly markets react on data these days. And it was ultimately reversed, but nonetheless, we saw that big move. And I don't know what that was. The reason for, I was kind of looking around because a lot of times us as human beings, we like to know, well, why did something happen? Can't just be because of no reason. It's got to be something. Something was there that, created this kind of upsurge. I was hard pressed to find anything for that Tuesday rally. That there was some technicals that maybe, okay, possibly. There was no real economic data in the United States, so maybe that was something that caused people to say, all right, well, at least we could buy and we can get in because, well, At least it's not going to be an economic numbers to persuade people to sell. So, okay, let's get in there. But the only thing I could find, the only thing, was this China number, which I didn't think was that much that could really rally a market as it did. But anyway, that was on Tuesday. Again, it was all reversed over the week. Dow was down about 1.16% for the week. The Nasdaq slipped about almost 0.5%. S&P 0.5% as well. Now, oil, like I mentioned earlier, closed at about 46.29. There was a big drawdown on the Wednesday number that came out where we do see the inventory numbers. About 3.5 million barrels of oil were actually drawn versus built into the inventory. So that was good. Some of that was probably due to the fact of some of the constraints that were being put on production from the Canadian oil sands, the Canadian fires that were going on. And there was actually we knew there was going to be probably about maybe six to 800,000 barrels taken offline a day. So, you know, calculate that out. And that would probably be right in line with what happened, actually. Now that I think about it, 5 days, 3 million. So yeah, that drawdown probably, however, there wasn't a build on the other side either. So that drawdown that was maybe representative of the Canadian drop due to the fires, maybe it was pretty good when you think about the fact that there wasn't any further builds that were building. I mean, if we had, you know, the net number is what we're looking at. So oil, well, that turned around pretty well, even though we did know that in terms of oil, the transitory nature of this fire issue is going to probably, you know, ramp up production very shortly. But we're continuing to see that when we look at the Baker Hughes rig count at the end of the week, there's a couple here and there, five or six that are offline each and every week. We're seeing the lowest production in terms of active wells. Now, what I mean by that is production is still high, but the active well count is down. And we knew that that was going to be the magic potion that would help oil actually start to regain some of its legs because of the simple supply-demand curve that goes along with the inability for many of these to produce. So oil did close at about 46.29. Now, what I mentioned on the opening was that there was this dislocation or a kind of a decoupling of oil and stocks. Now, we wanted to see this. We wanted to see on the other way, though. We wanted to see where oil was going down potentially and stocks can stay resilient. Now, that did happen and has happened. But what's interesting was oil was up and stocks were down for the week. Oil was up almost 6.5% for the week. So something is not right. Something taint right with that. Be better to see them moving in correlation with that kind of situation. But the decoupling, if it stays decoupled, at least we can breathe a little bit of sigh of relief that maybe some of the high-yield markets are a little bit less on edge. Maybe the oil companies are slowly but surely kind of having their way at being able to sustain some of the cash and not bleeding as much cash. We did see a couple more bankruptcies last week. I think Line Energy filed for bankruptcy, and there was another company too. I think it was Whiting, if I'm not mistaken. Filed for bankruptcy. I could be wrong about Whiting. But it was Line Energy, definitely was. Now, let's talk about real quickly before we get into some other discussions about what do we have expecting up for the week ahead. Now, if we were looking at retail sales from the aspect of the old line versus the new line, a new line would be the online players. Last week, we were looking at the old line. Now, we're going to look at the cheapies. You know, the companies like, we'll talk about the dollar stores, things of that nature. We're also going to have a variety of the other areas like Ross stores. But let's go through this real quick on a day-by-day basis. On Monday, Agilent Technology is going to be reporting. We're also going to be seeing Home Depot coming up on Tuesday, Red Robin, TJX. So we got Home Depot, which would be a really good benchmark to see that kind of sales, what's happening with the home improvement market and the housing market. We have TJX, which is clearly more of a discount retailer. Then we have a consumer price index coming out, April industrial output, housing starts, building permits all on Tuesday. Then it starts to ramp up a little bit more. We're going to see on Wednesday the Fed minutes. We got another Fed Reserve day, and these have been incredibly strong days for markets because the Fed in between meetings seems to be very hawkish, but when they get to their minutes, and any kind of output, they're extremely dovish. We'll see if that maintains. We'll see earnings from American Eagle Outfitters and Target. There we go. Is a one big one that we're going to be looking at. Target, in terms of what their discount type of company in terms of retail is going to play out. We've got Urban Outfitters as well, and that stock has been kind of all over the place. Williams-Sonoma, I just don't understand why that's still in business. You know, if you've ever been at one, there's never, ever since I can remember, there's never been anybody in that store. But, and there's so many other places that you can actually buy things that are that kind of, well, maybe not that price. I know the high prices for cooking equipment and for all sorts of cooking related goods and supplies. But anyway, Thursday, we're going to see initial claims report, earnings from Advanced Auto Parts, Applied Materials, Autodesk. Autodesk, of course, the 3D type of, and CAD drawings. And that ties into housing in a way and some of the 3D companies. We see Bon-Ton, Dick's Sporting Goods, Dollar Tree, Gap, their earnings overall. Let's see here. Perry Ellis, Ross Stores, Shoe Carnival, Stein Mart, and we're going to be seeing Walmart, which will be a biggie. Now, on Friday, we're going to get existing home sales and earnings from Campbell Soup, Deer, and Foot Locker. Now, Campbell Soup will be interesting to watch because they're known as a defensive play in the retail space, obviously soups and related products, but in the staples and not really consumer discretionary, so it's a little bit different, but I'm looking forward to seeing that. Obviously, Walmart, Ross Brands, Ross Stores, Target next week. I think these are going to be key levels to be looking at and what's happening. And again, let's just see what happens with Williams-Sonoma, if I can remember to watch that one. All right, let's shift gears here. That's next week coming up. And let me kind of go through my notes here, what I want to talk about. Okay. So over the last few weeks, we've been looking at, well, obviously the numbers from earnings of companies, and we've been seeing what they have been producing. And we have been looking at, obviously, what their guidance is. And we've been checking back on what the estimates are for the rest of the year. Now, the big question is, you know, what should we be watching these days? What's the thing that's really going to be moving markets that most appropriately, and what's the right thing? Now, earnings and economies, earnings and economics, the forward look and backward look at what's going on from a macro standpoint, and then also looking down and drilling down what's happening on a market basis, a sector basis, and an individual stock basis. The big question is what's going to be leading? Like what is it that we should be looking for? Now, historically, obviously, the economies were something that you could look at and you could say, well, if an economy is doing well, if you have a good GDP print and unemployment is good, manufacturing is up, factory orders are up, wage growth, all these good things that you look at, well, that's a good sign for the future of an economy. The problem is that these days, it's kind of taken as a question as to whether or not we're going to see continuation of any kind of stimulus from the government, and as such, markets aren't as happy when you see economies doing really well. Their dollar, their currency really moves up because the rest of the world is not doing well. And because we have a very fragmented type of economic situation, country by country and area, locale, if you will, around the world, what's happening is that it's being seen as a pretty negative implementation when there is a good trend. We saw what happened with the U.S. throughout the latter part of last year, where employment was doing much better, and we saw the GDP has been stabilized, inflation was picking up. It turned out to be a disaster for our markets throughout the end of last year and into the beginning of this year. Now that GDP slowed down a bit, and there's a question over, you know, the outward look of employment, and the Fed has become more dovish, the dollar went down a bit, well, things were, well, it's much better for the markets, right? People are much more happy. It's unfortunately a good is maybe good, a bad is good until that turns. And right now, there's a big question as to if economies and economics and, you know, those cycles are important when you have these algorithms and these high-frequency traders that are really playing on the whole idea that stimulus is really the whole, you know, muscle behind market moves. Then again, there's a lot of people watching oil. Oil is being a major play for how markets should move. The correlation and the decoupling or the movement that is similar for oil over the last year and a half, let's say. Is oil the thing we should be watching? Materials, by the way, also had been really dropping. Transports with them throughout the end of and maybe the last half of last year into this year. And that kind of just really took the wind out of the sails finally from markets. And just everybody threw in the sell button. And things got really out of hand for a number of weeks in terms of, you know, the markets. And the big question is, should we be watching this? Now, over the last few weeks, we saw this rotation prior to, I guess, a week and a half ago. So this rotation, this incredible move into materials, as there was some commentary out of China that they were going to stockpile again, that there was going to be the continuation of that policy of stimulating the economy through infrastructure development and building. And as such, we saw that copper and steel and rebar and all the materials really start to see a rally. And behind that, we saw the companies that were producing these that really did some job of either getting rid of part of their companies, closing down their operations and manufacturings and production, start to move up incredibly. Now, maybe they were oversold to a terrible degree, but really the fundamentals underlying a lot of the things that were pushing them down to levels that they were have not changed, because China already announced that they have enough materials, commodities. They have still a major surplus of these type of goods that they just are not going to be stockpiling like there was a thought there was going to be. Well, that sent a shiver down the backs of a company like U.S. Steel. Now, fortunately, we were able to short them in about the 1992 range, bought them back about $5 lower, and I'm talking about a 25% reduction in the price of U.S. Steel, which obviously is not a high-priced stock in the last, in the last week and a half. So that rotation that we saw that was so bold and so incredible, that was pushing all sorts of money into the energy stocks, into the materials, commodity-related, transports, seemed to stop on a dime again. And now all of a sudden, the markets are getting a little bit soft. We're not seeing that. We're seeing a lot of signs technically that we're topping off in a variety of different sectors, that the defensive sectors are coming back into vogue again, back into play after they're being sold off. Gold has been incredibly resilient. That's a sign of concern. Not a lot of inflation out there, so what are they buying gold for? Could be just a simple rotation, obviously. But the new numbers are in. Maybe this is the reason. Maybe that the thing that's leading the markets is the concern over the one of the most miserable, probably the most miserable quarter for earnings growth, because it was negative, again, since the mid-2000s. I mean, companies are really having a difficult time, whether it's because of the weather, whether it's because of the fires, whether it's because simply the dollar conversion's not going their way. Doesn't matter. I really don't care. The fact is, earnings, which are used as an input into figuring out what the valuation and the fair value of the current and future of a stock is. Now, that's not the only way. There's dividend discount models. There's a variety of other factors that can be used. But earnings are, for the most part, a very significant part of many analysts' calculations into price targets for stocks. So the big question is, what's the fair value of the S&P 500? And we've talked about this many times. And just, I think it was yesterday, I was reading an article that, well, the S&P is really cheap, because if you look at the dividend yield and a lot of this, listen, we can make any excuses we want as to the valuation of a stock. Take Amazon as a great example, or Netflix. You know, it's almost impossible to calculate what their PE is, but the stock keeps going up because there's a lot of opportunity and earnings potential for the company, and very thin margins maybe for Amazon. But there's a lot of people want this because they see the future there in a lot of different areas of what that company does. It's the outward look. It's just the way it does. Again, there are aberrations when it comes to this process. But what happens is, you know, it's really interesting that we're seeing that there is this model out there that shows that, well, if we invert the 10-year and we look at that compared to what the yield is on the S&P 500 is still very, very highly, I guess I would say, low valuation compared to where it could be. So we're not seeing extreme valuations yet in that model. So therefore, it makes that the S&P is cheap. But these days, it's kind of interesting. There's some talk about how low rates are good because what they do is they make stocks more attractive. Yes, that's true. Low rates are, in a time period where there are low rates, we could accept higher PE ratios. But here's what's really interesting and kind of screwy about this whole thing. When you look back and you think about it, when rates are low and going lower, it's a time when economies are usually slowing. And as such, whether it's going into recession, whether it's just a slowdown, whether it's the continuation of a particular economic condition, usually what happens is prices of stocks are adjusted lower and PEs are expected to be lower because the outward growth in the future is expected to be lower. Does that make sense? That makes sense to me, right? If you start lowering interest rates because economies aren't doing well, the fact of the matter is that stocks probably aren't going to do well in the future, or at least as well, or at least growth isn't going to be off the rails and really in great shape over the future. And therefore, what happens is the PEs are usually adjusted lower vis-a-vis stock prices going down. And what happens is that you see a situation where you have a lower PE. But right now what we see is that the acceptance of a low interest rate environment is leading us into the discussion that we can have low PEs. Kind of crazy. I think it's kind of crazy. Because if you look at it and you think about, high interest rates, therefore, would mean that the economies are doing better and we should really have stock PE multiples higher as well, right? Well, we can't have both. The funny thing about some of these cases, when you look at them, it's like the gas price argument, right? Well, if gas prices are going up, that's good for the consumer because that means that the wages are going up. That means that the economies are doing well. That means that there's a lot better employment. That's really a good thing. And the argument when gas prices are going down is that's really good for the consumer. It saves them money at the pump. They have more money to spend. And you know, it's a good thing. I'm like, how do you have that both ways? I mean, how do you go about with a straight face as an analyst, somebody coming on TV or radio or in print, or how do you have it both ways? It's impossible. Anyway, looking at the trend, the overall trend short term, clearly in a downtrend on the short term. I would call it a questionable downtrend, but in a downtrend, intermediate term is clearly up when I look at this, and longer term is down. But again, when I'm looking at now, when I back that up and I look at the S&P 500 and I look at the valuation, right now expectations are about $115 per share just in this weekend from S&P Direct. I'll put a chart up on thedisciplinedinvestor.com under the show notes on, you can see the trend of earnings estimates for the fiscal year 2016 and what they were back a year ago, projecting out to 2016 fiscal year, and what they are now. We were about 135 and now we're at about 115. Now, what does that say? It clearly tells us that, you know, there is a significant amount of change in the earnings outlook. And if you just simply adjust your PE and kind of keep on ratcheting it up, you'll get there. But if you don't, and what happens is that you simply look at the PE, let's say it's 17, valuations are a little bit frothy right now. Anyway, real quickly, we talk about a couple of things that were interesting. Apple did something interesting last week. They invested $1 billion in China's version of Uber. I was kind of wondering what that's all about. Is this showing commitment of China to China? I mean, remember something that Tim Cook came out several months ago and was talking about this major slowdown in China, and then he's kind of defended it. He made a rare appearance on CNBC and spent like an hour with Jim Cramer defending China and sales in India or potential in India and all sorts of other things about Apple and doing some weird comparisons with emerging markets and China over a two-year basis, which is kind of odd the way he did it. But nonetheless, I thought it was interesting. What's the story with this billion-dollar infusion into this Uber or the ride-sharing, ride-hailing type of program that's in China? Is this going to be the start of automation there that they may be looking at, and they're going to try to implement some of that there, or is that something different? It's kind of an interesting, I don't know, if you have any ideas what this is all about, and really not just some crazy, just something well thought out what this is about, I'd like to hear about it. Send me it to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, which you can send me all sorts of information there, questions, whatever you want. You can follow me on Twitter at Andrew Horowitz. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this whole Apple situation. Again, askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Let's talk about some fad things, and I want to mention something about DH Unplugged. Each and every week, we come together, myself and John C. Dvorak, to talk about, well, the news, business, investing ideas, just a whole host of things. Well, last week, I saw this crazy new thematic fad style investment that kind of hit me right in the face. It was the millennial, there's something X something thematic millennial ETF. And basically what they do is they buy stocks that they think will be profitable due to the millennial generation, right? Amazon, Facebook, LinkedIn, you know the names. You can think through them, just look out there and think about it. You know the names. And I was thinking about, a lot of times in history I've seen these kind of faddish types of investment deals, Y2K, women-only investments. I mean, just a lot of different ones out there. So what I thought we would do is have a little fun with it. So John and I got together. We made up a portfolio that was called the DH Old Codgers Portfolio Index, or the DH Old Codgers Index Portfolio. And what we did was we created about two dozen companies that are probably the antithesis of many of the companies that are in that millennial ETF. Companies like Sears, Denny's, Goldman Sachs, who else in there? DaVita, the dialysis company, McDonald's, Hormel. And what we did was we created this index, and we're tracking it now. As of, I think, the date was May 6th or 7th, we put this into play. This is the day that the millennial ETF came into being, where it first started trading. And we're tracking the performance on a daily basis and a since inception basis on the DH Unplugged website. Now, that should be up this week. We're just testing out, making sure all the numbers calculate correctly and we can keep this going. But just as a little fun game, I thought it would be the old codgers against the millennials. What do you think? A little battle of the ages. So that's going to be coming up on DH Unplugged. We'll talk about that each and every week, along with some of the other things we do with regard to the Close to the Pin competition, what we have with our listeners, where there's all sorts of nice little prizes and t-shirts that we give away and all sorts of other fun things. Make sure to listen to DH Unplugged this week, and I'll give you the insight of where we put that contest and battle and the update of that. Now, finally, I wanted to mention there's a couple of different companies out there that may be interesting to look at. Now, this, let me just tell you something. We're talking about not only Falling Knife, we're talking about some, like, wow, what happened? There's two companies, one in particular I was looking at. I was looking at Endopharmaceuticals. Now, obviously, we know that the pharmaceuticals have a tremendous amount of strain on them due to, well, politics and some of the things that are going on related to Valeant, and then with these the way that companies have been bought and price hiked and just all the things that are going on with the private way of pharmacy and off-book deals and blah, blah, blah. We know all about that. We talked about that, and hopefully you've been following a lot what's happening with that, and Valeant keeps on just going down, not being able to file the 10Q recently. But I was looking at Endo. Now, Endo has a variety of an arsenal of painkillers. They have a lot of topical testosterone and topical cream types of drugs, as well as a full load of other things, inclusive of painkillers, et cetera. Now, we know that some of the pain medications that have been out there are also under some fire, but their earnings came in, and over the last year, this stock has gone from about 96 down to, I think, a low of 1280. 1270, something recently, really bad. I mean, that stock chart looks just absolutely abysmal. However, I was looking at some of the fundamentals, and I really couldn't understand why we're seeing this big, you know, 85% drop of this company that doesn't, at least from what I can see, it doesn't have a lot of the factors like Mallinckrodt, like Valeant. It's not diversified very well. There's a lot of similar types of medications that they have. But this was once a great company with great earnings potential. And while I definitely see there is a crackdown on the painkiller type of medications, obviously keeping that kind of off the street. But some of their other stuff, I don't understand why there's such a problem in terms of the outlook for this company. Now, maybe there's something I'm not seeing here, but I mean, their earnings definitely have been slowing. There's been some guidance concerns that have been coming out there. The big question is, was this lumped into the pack? Was this lumped into all the others that are having problems just because, you know, what we've been seeing? And so I want to look at, well, where would the potential be a place to enter this for a short-term trade? So here's what happened. I looked. And okay, well, there's things that we've called in the past like a three-day rule. When something sells off after earnings or maybe moves up after earnings, you wait a couple of days, maybe 3 days, and kind of wait for all the settlement of the various buyers and sellers to kind of flush themselves out and then kind of make a period that you want to say, okay, well, if it gets to this point, maybe I'll buy in. And, you know, you do your work on your technicals, assuming all the fundamentals are done already and all that. These three-day rules, by the way, have turned out to be 1 and 2 day rules these days. You got to be really quick. Because it seems like nobody wants to wait anymore. Nobody has the patience anymore to wait for anything to play out. So this three-day rule thing has been compressed a little bit. But still, all right, let's take a look and let's let it rest. All right. The other thing you want to look for in a bounce play is a massive volume. You know, just see volume that just is really maybe 3-4 times the volume that we've seen historically on average. And a flush of the price or just a rally of the price either direction. Either one of the two. The flush is really what we're looking for in a bounce play, obviously. Oftentimes, this happens after earnings, right? So you see this when earnings come out, and you see that there's a surprise, possibly, and you see this big move of the stock, and you see the volume pick up. You wait a couple of days, and you know, people are like, okay, well, maybe next time will be better. You know, they start with that going on, the rationalization that, well, this is bad. Maybe this is the worst. Maybe this is the bottom. Next time will be better, and they start, you know, kind of moving it up a little bit. There's also things that you want to look for, and you want to look for clear support. You want to look for maybe doubles and triple bottoms or at least some really good support from things that we look at for like the programs that we put out for TradeStation on Trigger Charts, which is our altimeter, which is a volume-based study of support, which shows us where the buyers and sellers are, where that line in the sand is. And similar to when you draw a trend line, a horizontal trend line, similar to that, but different in that it not just price-based, it adds into it the volume as well. And you can look at where these levels are in terms of the action. It's called market profile. If you haven't looked into market profile, really, really cool because it gives you almost an x-ray vision of what's happening with the stock price. It's not just the price. And why did it bounce at that level? Why did it stop at that level? You know, why did it turn over and roll down? Well, because there are people that are leaving their little fingerprints all over in terms of the amount of volume that they press into a stock on a regular basis and the prices that they have. So we see that there's a tremendous amount of buying in terms of volume. And let's just pick a number for a stock, any stock, at $55. Well, we can see that very visibly with a market profile. And then we break it down even further. So when we look at this, and I looked at Endo Pharmaceuticals, I said, well, where is the level that I would feel comfortable owning it? And where would it be that if it did, in fact, bounce, that potentially there's a real nice ricochet that can happen? And then on top of that, of course, where would be my out on the up and the down? Like, where would I be like, all right, I'm done with this. It kind of kept on going. We clearly drew a trend line that was supported at about 1280, approximately 1280, give or take. It was actually in a range, I'll be honest, about 13 to about 1270. But when you took a look at that long term, go back on a weekly chart, many years, there was some really good support that would seem to start firing up the algos at those levels. So we put an order in. Stock was trading at about 1350 or so. So we put an order in about 8% lower, 9% lower, after a massive amount of flushing, that the flushes that happened already on the stock, big volume that happened after the earnings, already a stock that has been just obliterated. And actually, it hit at about 1280, 1275. So we hit on that level, and the stock is now, I think it closed Friday at about 14.11. This happened on Thursday, by the way. Thursday in the afternoon is when it hit, and then it just ricocheted and moved back. Now, where does it go from here is the big question. Well, first of all, the bigger question is, where do I get out of this if it works against me, if this doesn't play out? So what we're going to do is we're going to look at, obviously, below the level of about 1250, which would just be a total break and total disaster, as a level that would be just, okay, fine, take about a 25% loss on it, about, what is that, 2% at this point. That's good news. Now, on the top end here, there is a lot of area for this stock to run. It's got to get above this $14 level. But to be very honest with you, when you look at the daily chart, just look at the daily chart of ENDP. I mean, there's nothing there. Right now, we have a marker where we redrew in about 1775, but there's a giant gap. I mean, a giant gap up to about 25. That's significant. And if we do see that there were a lot of short sellers that piled in on the bottom, and now there's going to be a short squeeze, if, and a few more ifs after there. And if, in fact, that was the bottom, and if we did flush it out, and if, in fact, all these things came into play, well, there is the potential. Now, that would still be a 75% reduction in the price of the stock since last year this time. That's not small. But anyway, bounce plays. Falling knives, never catch a falling knife. Nope, that's not true. Never catch a falling knife if you don't have a plan. Never catch a falling knife if you don't get the flush, if you don't get to support, if you don't get to a level that is clearly a level that could be a level that would see some very supportive action. So just a point of reference. Kind of do away with some of the old line, you know, things that the 2-3 days rule. Okay, 3-day rule. Well, now it's more like 2. You got to change up. You got to kind of play with what's going on. You got to make sure to stay nimble. And, you know, be available to change your process a little bit if times change a little bit and things are going a lot faster because you have technology and very easy money policy. Just remember that. How many V's have we seen in the market, you know, when the market comes down and it just shoots right back up recently, right? A lot of money seems to be wanting to chase the buy side of things. Anyway, we're going to end it right there. I want to thank you for joining me. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and check out all things that we have there in terms of the show notes. Information on the strategies, how to follow me on Twitter. Make sure to do that, please. And in order to get in touch with me in terms of asking any questions, as well as some of the charts we talk about on this show each and every week. Until next week, I want to say goodbye. Have a great week and make it a profitable one at that. Bye-bye.
Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.